Hello. You've decided to listen to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Joshua Molina.
And I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. On this episode, we're talking about Season 2, Episode 14, The War at Home.
It was written by Aaron Sorkin. It was directed by Christopher Misiano. And it first aired on Valentine's Day, 2001, saving me the embarrassment of having to pronounce the name of its month.
It's Episode 214, Season 2, Episode 14, and it aired on 214.
Ah, that's so cute. That won't happen again for another 1,000 years.
Here's the synopsis from TV Guide. The crisis over the missing DEA agents in Colombia intensifies, and the fallout from the State of the Union address isn't so good either. For starters, a liberal senator is upset about the speech's Social Security suggestions. It doesn't look like the flap over the brutality accusation against the police officer Bartlett cited in the speech is going to go away quickly. And Joey Lucas's polling numbers are discouraging. Or are they? Meanwhile, Abby doesn't like the White House atmosphere.
Nice. We talked last episode about how this was essentially part two of Bartlett's Third State of the Union, but I didn't realize until watching ahead of our recording today, it's totally part two.
Yeah.
I mean, so much so that they really probably should have called this a two-parter.
Right.
It picks up where the last one left off, and it is absolutely the conclusion of what began the previous week.
Yeah. The episode begins with a frontal of Leo opening the door to come outside of the Oval Office to find the president.
President smoking.
Present smoking and without a jacket, despite the cold weather, which is a running thing throughout this episode.
Yes, outerwear is a major recurring theme.
And Leo tries to convince him that he should give up smoking. And the president inaccurately credits George Bernard Shaw with the line about,
George Bernard Shaw said you don't live longer, it just seems longer.
I'm not sure it was Shaw.
I'm not sure it was either.
And who actually said it?
It's actually said by Clement Freud, who's the grandson of Sigmund Freud.
Nice.
Yeah.
It was shocking to see. I remember seeing my grandfather, may he rest in peace, smoking once. We like met my grandparents for dinner, and I'd never seen my grandfather with a cigarette, and it was just a huge cognitive dissonance. My whole world turned upside down. It turned out my grandfather enjoyed a very occasional cigarette, and I felt the same way too. The president is smoking.
Mm-hmm. But you'd seen him smoke before. You knew he smoked.
This is a big episode for Big Tobacco altogether. We get to see Cigar Toby.
That's true. There's a Bob Woodward shout-out on Capitol Beat.
I'd like to thank all our guests tonight. Henry Shalick, David Satch, Toby Ziegler, Bob Woodward.
Jeff, which I thought was nice.
I noticed that. I thought it was kind of cute, but it was also like, huh, we didn't see him. It's funny that they only showed us the parts that had the cast of The West Wing on them.
But it reminded me about how much Aaron loves All the President's Men.
That is true.
Years before our podcast started, I went to a screening here in LA presented by Aaron at the Egyptian Theater. He presented All the President's Men. It was right around when Social Network came out, and he was talking about William Goldman as his mentor and the idea of creating a movie out of recent events instead of waiting, you know, decades to make something about American history that's already been written in the textbooks. He was doing something similar with Social Network, writing a movie about essentially current events. But he was like, All the President's Men did the same thing. This movie came out just barely years after Watergate all unfolded.
Right. And one could certainly argue that that's what Aaron had previously done with The West Wing. Even though it's not necessarily ripped from the headlines, it's, it was certainly of its time.
Yeah, taking plot inspiration from stuff that had happened just months earlier, or maybe even weeks at times with the Clinton administration. What I like about this episode is there are a few attempted telediscs, but they're kind of thwarted from the usual model that we have in the show, where instead of Donna asking an innocent question and then Josh getting to explain it to her, in this episode, there are several times when that kind of formula is set up, but then it gets diverted.
Josh literally says to Donna at one point,
why do you ask me the question when you're going to have the conversation all by yourself?
Which is a clever line, but also reflected how I was feeling as a viewer at that moment.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually liked this episode very, very much, but there were several moments when I felt, well, you're really laying it out for us, aren't you?
Yeah.
Even though, to be honest, there are times I need the information or I like it or I need a little refresher on what they're talking about. So I'm not saying I'm above it, but I don't like feeling like I'm in a classroom. And I felt that way at a couple points.
Yeah. Well, maybe this was Aaron's way of trying to diffuse that a little bit. You know, undercutting his own exposition.
Do I need to lay out the ways in which this man is important to us?
No. He is adored by the left.
Stop laying out the ways.
It's a kind of clever because Toby's like, you don't need to be saying this. You don't need to keep saying this. And yet it's also delivering simultaneously. It's delivering all the exposition that we might want.
Yeah, it's not like I have a better solution. It is a challenge that faces Aaron and the other writers of The West Wing over and over and over just by the nature of the show. You know, there's a viewership with differing amounts of knowledge as a base, and there are certain things we have to be up to speed on to have a sense of what's going on. And so it's a, you know, episode by episode, a challenge sometimes to bring along the audience without feeling like you're putting them in a classroom or that you're talking down to them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the one thing that I did like about that Josh and Donna exchange that you were talking about, because it isn't like Donna sitting in the classroom where Josh is teaching. This was a little bit different because she already had all the answers and she was kind of doing a weird Socratic method with herself through Josh. She was essentially having a monologue with Josh as somebody to bounce the stuff off of.
I think that's why for me it was one step worse than Attila Donna.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, well, neither of the characters on screen needs this information, so they can only be speaking to those of us who are watching the show, and they're not supposed to know that we're watching them.
It reminds me a little bit of like a Sorkin theme of like the line, you can either ask the questions or you can answer them, but you can't do both. But of course, people do both all the time on the show.
Also true. Mm-hmm.
Back to the Sam and Toby exchange about Seth Gillette, though. Sam very innocently answers the question about him setting up the meeting. Toby's like, you set it up already? And Sam's like,
just the time and place.
Yeah, that's a funny line.
Just like how on the last episode, you knew that the plot lines were unresolved by the end of the episode, even though you didn't know yet that that was going to be a part two. You get the same kind of feeling with Seth Gillette, because they bring in Ed Begley Jr. for Seth Gillette, and he has one fantastic scene with Toby. But then that's it. And you're like, well, you know that guy's going to be back.
Ed Begley Jr., I should say, is such a great actor because I thought he was terrific in this role. And for me, he's always battling the image of him in Son of the Invisible Man from Amazon Women on the Moon. Have you ever seen that movie?
I've never
an anthology movie.
No.
You should watch it. It's on YouTube in its entirety. It's an anthology comedy, like a sketch movie. And he plays the son of the Invisible Man who is convinced that he has replicated his father's formula for the solution that makes you invisible.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's all wrapped up and he reveals himself to his friend and slowly unwraps himself. And he's not in fact invisible. And he unwraps himself down to nakedness. And then he's like, ooh, look, the phone is floating in the air. And then he goes to a bar. He goes to a bar and tries to do all these crazy tricks around people, not realizing that he is naked and not invisible. It's very, very funny. And so for him to then convince me as the junior senator from North Dakota is an impressive feat.
Yeah.
I also like the inter-party battling of centrist Toby trying to deflect an attack from the left.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic because a lot of times within the administration, he really plays more of the role that Seth Gillette is doing, where he's pushing
indeed
centrist policies more to the left. He's trying to be truer to their liberal ideology, and here he's got to play devil's advocate. Well, not devil's advocate. I think he actually believes what he's saying, but...
Yeah, I do too, I think, but it's an interesting shift to and a reversal of his usual position vis-a-vis the rest of our heroes and as he tries to push them to the left. And I love his line.
And the president's not a member of your party. He's the leader of your party.
That whole scene is... there are two exchanges between the president and the first lady, their big scene, and then this is the other big scene for me in this episode. I love when Toby tells him...
Go to bed. Would you please?
That's so good.
Yeah, it's an interesting turn of phrase. I like it too.
The go to bed line also, by the way, reminded me of will you go to lunch in Glengarry Glen Ross.
Now, will you go to lunch? Go to lunch. Will you go to lunch?
It's one of my favorite parts of that whole play.
That's good. That is similar.
Yeah, that really, really landed with me. And I do like that, you know, this episode has a lot of sort of the big plot points because it involves international diplomacy and military plots and stuff like that. And I like that in the middle of all of that, this kind of like international stage, there's also this extremely policy-oriented domestic battle that's happening between Toby and the senator.
Yeah, and then there are actual policy-related domestic squabbles going on. I mean, what's happening between the president and his wife is very personal.
Yeah.
And they get hot quickly in that first scene. I love how quickly the temperature turns up. Stalker's on fire.
Yeah.
And it's just great that they never lose the layers of being a close, loving couple, but one that knows how to push each other's buttons and that never fails to do so. And it's just great acting.
We didn't get a chance to talk again last night.
I don't think we should.
Talk?
No.
Ever?
Oh, if wishing made it so, Jed.
Look.
I don't think it's a good idea for us to talk about this now.
Why?
Because you got to focus on Columbia.
I can do two things at once.
I love the sparks flying. I thought watching this episode, there's both a lot of subtlety going on, and then there are some clunkier aspects, like, you know, leaving the sit room to go play chess. Okay.
Right.
You know, it's funny. Which even in its clunkiness, I actually liked the idea of Leo and the president having this conversation, and they're both still looking four moves ahead on the chessboard, even as, you know, they're trying to figure out what to do in this international. You know, I didn't mind it, even as I kind of like, okay, I get it. They're playing chess. I still kind of liked it.
I like that Leo in that scene is still the president's wartime consigliere, even on the chessboard, that in a moment like that, the president, who's such a great chess player, he can't see all the moves and he needs Leo to whisper some of them to him. And Leo is quietly sort of coaching him.
Mm-hmm. I also had a whopper of a hashtag Trump III moment. In that first sit room scene, Martin Sheen plays so beautifully, the president asking for advice.
Do we know where they are?
They were moved about 60 miles into the jungle at Villa Sereno.
What would it take to get them back?
This is a president that we know doesn't have military experience, and we see him later, in fact, to refer to the Black Hawk having been shot down by one of those shoulder thingies.
Right.
So something like that.
Yeah.
He doesn't know the terminology. The stakes of the moment are just so clear, and he wants to hear from this group of experts that he's assembled. And all I could think was that we're days away from a president who famously said,
I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me.
A man who is famously leery of advice.
Right.
And it just sat with me, that scene in the Situation Room, because you see the incredible downside of being the president, or just what it entails and the monumental nature of the responsibilities involved. And you want to believe that you've got somebody, regardless of whether you agree with the ultimate decisions, somebody who takes the decisions with the weight that Bartlett does.
Yeah. Well, let me play devil's advocate for a second. The reason why this whole mission goes so badly is because of bad intelligence.
Yes.
And that is a reason that Trump has cited for discrediting the intelligence community. You know, like, he doesn't take the briefings seriously, or he's sort of denigrated those briefings in general, because he points to the invasion of Iraq and all these things that have come out of the intelligence community and saying that these guys are useless. I don't need them. I'm not exactly sure how he's going to find anything out without them, but still the idea of that misinformation is sometimes worse than no information. There is an argument to be made for that stance in this episode.
I don't see how no information, rather than the information at hand that may be faulty, is somehow preferable.
I'm not saying that it's a logical stance to take, but I'm saying at a surface level, this episode provides some ammo for that stance.
Yeah, I guess, look, it provides ammo, so to speak, for question intelligence, certainly. Mm-hmm. Question your intelligence, and I'm really jumping ahead, but Leo later in the episode cites Vietnam and his service there.
If I could put myself anywhere in time, it would be the cabinet room on August 4th, 1964, when our ships were attacked by North Vietnam in the Tonkin Gulf. I'd say, Mr. President, don't do it. You're considering authorizing a massive commitment of troops and throwing in our lot with torturers and panderers, leaders without principle and soldiers without conviction, with no clear mission and no end in sight.
That, coupled with the fact that the episode deals with faulty intelligence, obviously put me in mind of the messy, long war with no end in sight that the U.S. is about to go into not long after this episode.
Right.
Given all that, I loved that the final images of the episode were, in fact, of flag-draped coffins of the war dead, given that one of the, I think, continuing controversies during Iraq and Afghanistan, although it was a pre-existing policy, that there was a media ban exactly showing those images.
Right.
That ban has been lifted, but there was a ban on the media showing exactly these kinds of images that Christopher Misiano and producers of the show decided to end the episode with. And I thought that was a very strong and powerful way to conclude.
Yeah. And also just the pathos from Martin Sheen.
Oh, yeah. I loved his, it's a little bit of a taste of what I know we're going to get soon in another episode. I love the just railing, ranting against the injustice of life that you sometimes get from Bartlett.
Sir, we weren't prepared for someone to try and outfox us with a stratagem so sophisticated it's an entire generation beyond. Hey, look, your shoelaces are untied. Is that how I just lost 9 guys to a damn street gang with a ham radio? They lured us there so that they could kill 9 American soldiers.
Yeah.
It's kind of great.
But more than his anger, I think I really was moved by his grief at the end. And that was sort of my Trump IIA moment a little bit. I was thinking about how a president's job is not just to be a blustery force at the podium, but they should also be able to channel the national mood somewhat. And that requires a level of empathy. And just looking at that image of the West Wing president, I was just trying to reconcile that with the reality of what we were going to have for the next 4 years. And I was like, this is just a moment that would never happen in the upcoming administration.
I suspect you're right. What do we know? But I suspect you're right. And that's what I thought that throughout. And it was also, it goes also beyond the president to all our heroes, down to Charlie, you can see are rocked and want to do what they can for each other in the most human way. I mean, in a way that's, in light of it earlier, but all this concern about outerwear, I thought was it's kind of the sweet flip side of just the monumental decisions and ramifications of those decisions going on with the administration. And then the flip side of just this human to human. Oh, is my assistant going to remember to bring a sweater? Yes, ma'am. You mentioned that already. And, you know, Charlie, can I get you a jacket? And there's just, I like that the way they would treat each other seems to be reflected in how they take their responsibilities to the nation.
Yeah.
The micro and the macro.
One thing I didn't like in this episode was a sense that a lot of the characters were talking about Black people in America as like a group separate from themselves, like with a distinct kind of sense of other. And that's certainly understandable, as, you know, when Toby and CJ are talking about the African-American population, they are not members of that population. But the most jarring for me was when Toby used the word blacks.
Because blacks aren't going to react well to our supporting a brutal cop.
He's not a brutal cop.
Maybe this is going to strike some people as being like overly politically correct, but I feel like that is an outmoded term. That's a relic from an older era that just rings flat. It sounds a little offensive.
Yeah, interesting. I didn't bump on that word or that moment. I don't recall it. I did agree with you. I did write down that I kept thinking that over the course of the episode, the Black community or the Black population were quantified as this political unit. And it was most glaring for me, I thought, when back to the cop, is it Sloan?
Yes, Jack Sloan.
Back to that little plot line where it turns out, according to CJ, that, and again, I had to revise my opinion about what we discussed last episode. I now fully believe that we are meant to believe that he was falsely accused and that he was absolutely innocent of aggressive police tactics. To me, it actually now does pair, although it's an interesting, maybe a little flip side to this, what bothered me about Celestial Navigation. We didn't see it dramatized, and we don't have a lot of points of view. We are just, now that CJ is telling us that he was falsely accused, and she doesn't know, it's what she believes, but I do believe it's one of those things, again, where we're supposed to just believe that, even though we don't have that much information. And she sounded kind of offhandedly explains that the only reason he was cited was to pacify the Black community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just as if that wouldn't be a horrendous
right
injustice to the cop. It's also kind of patronizing.
It's absolutely
of the
patronizing
Black community.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we just kind of rushed past this moment. And I thought, wow, it's just political calculus in a very
heartless,
very coarse way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which doesn't necessarily make it bad West Wing, but it's worth noting. I mean, I thought it was interesting. It's more information about the characters and how they act. And it took everybody down a little. notch for me.
Yeah. I wanted to, just because we focus on language so much and the show is so focused on language so much, I did want to talk for a second about that idea about, because it's something that I've noticed in our own episodes sometimes when just the language that you and I will choose, like African-American versus Black. I don't use the term African-American usually because I feel like it presumes too much, maybe, because if your ancestors came over in the 17th century or 18th century to like somehow qualify your status as American, like it's a qualifier, you know, African-American that distinguishes from just American. Versus when, at least the way I think of it when I say Black, it's more about referring to someone's appearance, the way that you might say somebody is blonde or blue-eyed. Like if someone's ancestry was from Haiti, would it be, you know, you just have to make an assumption if they're a generation removed or you don't know anything about them. So I tend to stay away from that. But I also think that maybe that seems like dangerous territory. And I think it can be in a moment like this when Toby, for me, misuses it by saying Blacks. You know, like that is a... like I said, that just sounds like old-fashioned in a way that is uncomfortable. And it's a strange thing to have to parse, but I wanted to bring it up.
Feels like something Toby would say, though. Of course, it is something Toby said, so
right.
Maybe that's why. But
I remember there reading something about, like in style guides, either the Manual of Style or New York Times, or maybe it was all of them, about which is the preferred or which is acceptable, you know, to use to say like Black people is okay, but to say Blacks, that's not okay. Maybe this is just semantics. I mean, I guess it is technically just semantics, but yeah, it feels like it's charged in a different way.
Yeah, I get that.
Like, I don't use the term Indian American for myself for the same thing of like, I'm not wanting to feel like a qualifier, like I'm somehow less American than somebody whose parents aren't from India. I was born here and I'm an American.
Yeah. Well, I sometimes think about whether I'm Jewish American or an American Jew, and whether which one I'm emphasizing. Which, you know, well, I mean, it's like it is because I care about language too and the precision of it.
Of course,
am I an American first? Am I a Jew first? And you know, one implies one, and one implies the other.
Right.
Somebody was just recently, I didn't get into it with them, I was very pleased with myself, but on Twitter going off again, she obviously had just listened to the Celestial Navigation episode.
I saw that.
Well, what she seemed to take away was that I thought it unlikely that there would be a driving while brown incident.
Right.
Which again, of course, was not my point. But then she was also just haranguing us both, really, for our white privilege.
Yeah.
As two white guys.
Yeah.
And should I start? Nah, I'm just going to leave it.
Same thing. I started to write a response to be like, here's my profile picture. And then I was like, you're right. I have no idea about racial profiling. I have no experience with that.
Yeah. I was going to go there and I thought, nah, I'll let Rishi. Yeah. I figured you weren't even noticing it. I'm not going to bring it to his, you know, you can't go one-on-one with every single person, but there you go.
It's my New Year's resolution to get to.
Now that we have an Instagram account, maybe that'll happen less frequently.
Right. Fewer Twitter fights, more Instagram fun.
That's right. But you can see what we look like too.
Oh, that's true. I see what you're saying.
There's pictures of us.
Yeah.
Stop with the two white guys comment. Another scene that came off in a more tendentious manner than was probably intended was the breakfast with Bartlett, where he would teach Josh and Sam the basics about incarceration on drug charges.
Right.
We imprison a higher percentage of our citizens than Russia did under communism and South Africa under apartheid. Somewhere between 50 and 85% of the prison population has a drug or alcohol abuse problem. We've tried, just say no. I don't think it's going to work.
Really? This is the level of conversation that these three people are having?
Right.
Or is this happening for us, the viewers?
Oh, look at these domestic policy experts getting a 101
or having
course.
A little basic primer on incarceration for drug charges.
For this episode, Stockard Channing was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for an Emmy.
Ah, that's interesting. I think that's great. She was terrific in this episode. You don't need a lot of screen time to score when you've got good material and you're that good an actor, because she's not really on much, but she lights up the joint as soon as she's on screen.
Yeah. I was thinking about, like, because this is a two-parter, how they might have chosen, you know, episode 14 versus episode 13, because she delivers a terrific performance in both of them. But I thought, what puts this one over the top for me, the reason why I'm like, okay, yeah, this is the more difficult needle to thread, is she has to say the words, I love you.
Call me when you get there.
I will.
I love you.
I love you too.
Could you give an actor three harder words to say and not mess up? I don't think you can. It's such a loaded phrase. How do you say it and be true to the moment and true to the character and all these things? And the way they say it has so much subtext.
Very, very nicely put. That's a very, very good point. The subtext of their relationship, which goes back for years and years, which always feels present. And also they're saying it to each other in a situation where there's so much going on.
Yeah.
Emotionally, of anger, betrayal.
Lying to God.
Yeah, yeah. I also liked when she laid into him about the promise that Bartlett had made her vis-a-vis his MS and not running for a second term. I mean, I like the personal nature of what it means between the two of them, this decision to run again or not, but also the real transgression of covering it up and keeping it from the public.
I don't know if it's going to get better. I don't know if it's going to get worse. But we had a deal. And that deal was how you justified keeping it a secret from the world. It's how you justified it to God. It's how you justified it to me.
There's something very significantly wrong that he's done to have kept this disease that can have the effects that she lists.
Yeah.
That's a major deal for a president.
Absolutely, yeah. And the line she repeats, she says, it's how you justified keeping it a secret from the world. And that is such a huge bomb to drop, because I don't think that we've really considered the secrecy of it. Of course, has come up because of the
assassination attempt.
The anesthesiologist. But that idea of running only for one term is how he justified keeping it secret from the world. Just an elegant parallel structure that gets delivered there, justifying it from the world, justifying it to God, justifying it to her. And also I like the order in which that happens, like as if the stakes get raised with each one and she comes last.
Nice observation. Yeah, very good point. And it also speaks to the ingredient of ego, I think, which is something I always think about, that part of the problem with our system is that you have to be a raving egomaniac to want to be president.
Right.
He figured, well, in any event, he can get through one term before any of these potentially devastating symptoms catch up with him.
Right.
But even without his admitting it to himself or to his wife, he wants it more. He wants it longer. And he's telling you it's because he wants to get stuff done. And you only get 18 months to govern. But you can taste the element, too, of also he's had this power. He is the president and he wants another term.
Yeah. The secrecy of it, too, I thought had a really neat parallel in the plot with Columbia. There's a line that Leo delivers.
Those 14 people keep bigger secrets than this.
Talking about the exchange that the president of Colombia makes, the offer to let Aguilar go in exchange for the DEA agents. And the president says, you know, like, how can we trust him? There was a callback in the line where he says,
you know what Truman Capote said was the bad part about living outside the law?
What?
You no longer have the protection of it.
It wasn't totally connected, but I felt like the seeds were planted. That idea of his keeping his MS secret kind of lays the foundation of this idea of like, once you're living outside the law, you no longer have the protection of it. And his justifying this to God, if he suddenly transgresses from that, this like weird jerry-rigged deal that he's made with his own faith and family, and now he's going to even stretch beyond that. He's on his own.
Well, now you're leading me into the one area of the plot that I bumped on slightly, and I thought, get Rishi to explain this to you. So, how does it resolve? It's an interesting resolution, I thought. I mean, the question of whether you negotiate with terrorists is an ongoing one, and so I thought it's a clever resolution that what they do is they do so, but with the cover of not having done so.
Right.
But how does the president of Colombia allow the public story to be that Aguilar was released on his word when it's so clear in the phone call that he's saying to the president through his interpreter, I will do this if you say the word, and no, I don't think it's the right decision.
Right.
So how does it play out? How could it play out that Santos would take the public pushback for having made the decision on his own when that's not what happened?
Yeah, especially given how strongly the argument for not negotiating with terrorists is made, it's like, okay, well, yes, that's what the U.S. does, but Colombia, they can waver on that.
Right. I would think this is not going to play well for Santos.
Yeah.
Like, how does, I mean, maybe it's just one of those things where it's best not to. Best not to. It doesn't make that much sense in a way. Like,
I think that's what
given,
it is.
I guess not. Yeah, I think it doesn't.
Yeah, because it would be pretty raw for the president of Colombia to capitulate to the cartel and like let out this guy from jail. I mean, that's
right.
Really,
yeah,
tough.
I mean, that works out very nicely for Bartlett, but yes. I don't think Santos would let it play out quite that way for him.
DSX Colombia.
Yeah, there you go.
How about President Santos, though?
I did think that, too.
Calling him President Santos, that's pretty good. There actually is, Colombia has had a President Santos, but even that was in the future of the show. He was elected, you know, the current president of Colombia is President Santos.
Oh, is that the case?
Yeah, but he didn't come into office until 2010. So it was kind of prescient on a couple levels.
Apparently. What about a little comic subplot and Ainsley's second meeting with President Bartlett?
I liked how Sam kept making it about she said that thing about
the House of Atreus.
Yeah, exactly. And she mentioned about how, like, the disgrace that she's brought upon her and her father. And Sam really runs with that.
Don't you have to absolve yourself of the humiliation visited on your family and the House of Atreus?
Yeah. I mean, it's just another one of those scenes that makes me want to see Aaron Sorkin's version of Noises Off.
Right.
It's just, he's got her walking, you know, the joke about she needs to pee.
How you doing, Angelina?
I'm concerned about peeing on your carpet.
Okay. Well, now I am too.
Yeah. And then she leaves to go to the bathroom and walks into the closet, and then the president enters. I mean, Aaron is absolutely capable of, you know, door slamming farce.
Right.
And I love when it shows up on the West Wing, and I want to see undiluted farce from Aaron. I don't think he'll ever do it.
Yeah.
I don't know. He just doesn't have it in him to leave greater issues behind.
Yeah.
But I would love to, if I could get that out of him. I want to see it. I want to be in it.
Maybe you can get him to write you a one-act slapstick.
Perhaps, in his spare time.
I love in that scene with Ainsley, too, when Sam goes to try and retrieve Ainsley from the closet, his body language as he just, as he moves past, like gingerly past the president.
It's very funny.
It's really good.
It's very well written and performed.
There's a great part where at the very end of that scene, you know, he gives her this compliment of like, you're very bright and we're proud to have you. And then he says, listen, he puts his hand on her arm and he says, listen. And then he gets cut off because of the situation in Colombia and they have to pull him out. But you just know that he was going to give her one of these like fantastic, you know, just pearls of Bartlett-y goodness. And, you know,
that she'll never forget, but she doesn't get it. Yeah. He does give her a nice moment, though, somehow. I don't know if he somehow intuits that her father's very important to her.
Right.
Says something about your father must be very proud of you.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that's almost like, that's other level. He just somehow senses she's got a daddy. Either that or Sam has told him, but.
Right. Good staff work.
Yeah.
On that note, let's take a quick break. And now back to the show. What about the back to the Seth Gillette conversation? Toby drops the anemones line.
And the fish says, with friends like this, who needs anemones?
Yeah, what the hell?
And I thought, that's a weird time to deploy a groaner.
I thought so too. It's like, wow, why don't you just pull out like, hey, I cut this family circle out of the paper. It's a particularly funny one. It didn't land, but like with this, that's some seriously relevant comedy right there. I was like, that's just a bad joke. That belongs on the podcast, not on the actual show.
I had a couple other stray observations. There's a line that the first lady says where she says,
when was the last time you packed a suitcase at all?
It made me think about something I'd read in an article about Hillary Clinton months ago. I think maybe talking about her relatability or just talking about her candidacy in general and how hard it is to ask someone to be relatable when they haven't driven themselves in a car for over 20 years.
Yeah, there you go. Wasn't there something about Bush not knowing the price of a loaf of bread or
a
gallon of milk?
Yeah.
Yeah, these people aren't people. They're another species.
Yeah, by design. They're shielded from that kind of experience, so. Another stray observation. I thought that camel-colored turtleneck that Donna wears is really a great color for her. Good for her coloring.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Well, let's talk. We haven't talked to Josh and Donna. I loved when Joey finally lays it all out for him, both in terms of what poll numbers mean and how numbers work, and his relationship with Donna. It's kind of fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, that came up in our conversation with 538, and I think I mentioned it then, that that little passage in the episode was really eye-opening for me, too.
You don't know what these numbers just told you. I'm an expert. I don't know what these numbers just told you.
We know.
We?
Numbers don't lie.
They lie all the time. They lie when 72% of Americans say they're tired of a sex scandal, while all the while, newspaper circulation goes through the roof for anyone featuring the story. If you polled 100 Donnas and asked them if they think we should go out, you'd get a high positive response. But the poll wouldn't tell you it's because she likes you, and she knows it's beginning to show, and she needs to cover herself with misdirection.
That was like a perfectly formed little nugget of information that I was like, oh, right. Like, here, let us use this very concrete example to explain how something like this statistic wouldn't make sense. And yeah, that's a really, really fantastic scene. This is a good episode.
It is. It's a very good episode.
Yeah. She lays it all out for him, like you said. And even then, at the end, Josh's response is,
believe me when I tell you that's not true.
Oh, I know. I was like, dude.
Like, who's he convincing?
Yeah, exactly. There's nobody out here in the world you're living in or among the millions who are watching that buys that. I mean, yeah. It's interesting. It's insight into him as a character. I don't think of him as just utterly delusional, but he's so off.
Yeah. Well, and it's also strange given his conversation with Sam.
Right. It's really dishonest more than delusional.
Exactly, yeah. And I'm like, is he lying because he's still trying to flirt with Joey and he doesn't want to bring in this element of love triangle to it? But yeah, in his conversation with Sam, it seems like he's very aware of what the stakes are and what the dynamic is between them on both sides. And he doesn't understand her way of navigating, you know, like Joey Lucas explains to him her way of navigating through this dynamic, but that he has a very different one where he gets in the way actively of Donna going on dates with other guys. But I also like how Sam just has not been paying attention and doesn't care at all.
Joey, a little bit over him, I think, at this point. I don't know if I'm over, but she's seen what she's seen. She's maybe a little bit tired of waiting for Josh to ask her out or make a move.
I think she knows she'd be dating down.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. No offense to Brad. Oh, no, offense to Brad.
Because Joey's in this episode, of course, we get Kenny in the episode as well. And at the end, when the president is doing his phone call with President Santos, there's the translator. We don't actually hear his voice. We hear the translator. And I love how this happens, that on this show, words are so specific and so important, but the voices aren't necessarily. And there's this great dramatic dynamic that emerges from having someone who is not the author of the words speaking someone else's words. And I liked that guy who they had for the translator, who was played by Adam Alexi Mall.
Oh, that's right. I also wanted to give a shout out. The character of Mickey Troop. Tony Plana is the actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the assistant secretary of state.
It doesn't say. I was looking and I'm not sure what his position is. Mickey Troop is the character's name. Is that what he is?
I think he's the assistant secretary of state for South America, something like that.
Huge hat tip for playing Jefe in Three Amigos. One of my all-time favorite and I think worldwide underrated movies.
That's so funny because that movie loomed so large in my childhood.
How?
That it's hard to imagine it being underrated. All of my friends were in love with that movie.
Interesting. See, that for me is the most frequent movie that I've made other people watch and had them turn to me and go, really? I'm always like, yeah, I love this movie.
I was like 8 when I'm talking about a moment when, you know, my friends in
third grade. Well, I'm talking about making adults watch it.
So I'm not sure that
it's possible that I have not progressed emotionally.
But I think about it all the time. How do you know it's a male plane? See the tiny balls? I thought it was really interesting, too, when Mickey Troop is talking about the kind of victory that the American people are used to.
Mr. President, for the kind of victory Americans are used to, for the kind of victory Americans demand from a war, you need a 10-to-1 ratio.
That idea of, like, the branding of conflict, you know, that, like, you have to consider the ratings. It's not good enough just to accomplish the mission. You have to do it in a way that's going to also feel good.
Play well.
Yeah, play well. Well, thanks so much for listening. Thanks for joining us. We hope you'll join us next time. when we'll be talking about episode 215, which is called Ellie.
Till then, there are all sorts of things you can do. You can follow us on Twitter. Rishi is at Rishi Hirway. I'm at Josh Molina. The show is at West Wing Weekly. You can like our Facebook page.
It's facebook.com/The West Wing Weekly.
We now have an Instagram account.
Big news, which is at The West Wing Weekly.
Follow us there. You can also, as you should have been doing all along, you can listen to Rishi's other podcast, Song Exploder.
Another thing that's happening this week, this episode comes out on January 17th.
Woo!
An auspicious date. Everybody say happy birthday to Josh.
Should I make it to January 17th, I will be 51. If you want to honor the anniversary of my birth by donating to mazon.org, M-A-Z-O-N.org, $54 will get you a follow back on Twitter.
This is also very exciting because we just put out yesterday, we put out What's Next, our song featuring Lin-Manuel Miranda, whose birthday was yesterday, January 16th. You guys have back-to-back birthdays.
If you would like to honor Lin's birthday, you can do so by making a donation to mazon.org. I don't know whether he cares, but I think it's a nice way to celebrate his birthday.
Do you know what I think about every time I think about Mazon? I always think about Kanye West.
Why is that? In the throne. Don't let me into my zone. Don't let me into my zone. I'm definitely in my zone. That is awesome. I forgot that he was such a...
He's such a huge Mazon supporter, yeah.
And their wonderful work.
This episode was produced by Josh and me, with help from Zach McNeese and Margaret Miller.
The West Wing Weekly is a very proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a curated network of extraordinary story-driven shows. You can learn more at radiotopia.fm.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.